Hi everyone, I'm Greg Lowe from Down Under in Australia. PG Down Under is a production from SQL Down Under. It covers Postgres, aspects of which are owned by the Postgres Global Development Group and the Regents of the University of California. Opinions and views expressed in the podcast are individual and don't necessarily reflect the opinions and views of SQL Down Under, of the owning organizations, or the organizations that guests are part of.
Introducing Show 2 with guest John Miner. Welcome. Our guest today is John Miner. John's a data architect at Insight in the USA. Over many years, John was a data platform MVP. He's a strong community contributor and blogs at craftydba.com. So welcome, John.
Hey, Greg. Thank you for having me.
It is so good to get to talk to you today. So, and normally, we previously would have been talking about SQL Server or Fabric, but today it's Postgres.
Or Spark.
Or Spark, yeah, indeed.
Whatever flavor that you like working with, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be Fabric. It could be, you know, Synapse has it buried in there somewhere, right, if you look hard enough. And you can also do it in Databricks and a lot of other tools and other platforms. Mm. But yes, first I want to preface this is that I had the wonder of working with Postgres for about 6 months. Am I an expert at it? No, but I'm here to tell you what I learned down those 6 months to migrate stuff from SQL Server to Postgres.
Excellent. Yeah, in fact, that's exactly the experience I was sort of looking for as someone who's recently done some migration. In fact, curiously, I did migration of Wide World Importers. I actually wrote Wide World Importers back in 2016 for the SQL Server team. And
I did
one
not
of the
know
things.
That.
Yeah, and one of the things I did produce was a Postgres version of that same thing. But at the time, the group, let's say, weren't as keen to release that, you know.
It's kind of like, you know, the love-hate between Oracle and SQL Server, you know.
Yeah, but I had a, you know, I just knew that was going to be something useful going forward. So there was a version of that around, and I've still seen it kicking around in a few different spots. And in fact, I was watching a session recently from Ryan Booz, and he was using it. So I thought, cool.
Okay, so awesome.
It does exist in the wild. But anyway,
so let me tell you about what I did. And what's precursor to Worldwide Importers was AdventureWorks, right? And you've been around as long as me. What was before AdventureWorks?
Well, pubs, yeah.
And so, guess what? I actually translated pubs over to Postgres SQL. So if you look at my GitHub repo, you'll see it out there.
Yeah, in fact, pubs has been around an extraordinarily long time. In fact, I had a little while ago, I had a version of SQL Server 1.1 running. I had pubs on that, right? So it was fascinating to watch. Even the tools and everything were different. But Postgres is the thing today. So look, why did you get interested in Postgres at all? Tell me the story.
Sure. So, you know, let me give you a little background because I looked this up and I didn't know it myself. You know, most of these databases have a history, right? Like SQL Server was like a twin of Sybase, and Sybase kind of like fell, and you don't hear about Sybase anymore, but it was really big in the 90s, and SQL Server, you know, took it all over, right? It's the same thing with,
I think they made a critical mistake, right? Sybase was in a pretty good position, but the deal they did with Microsoft was they would do the Unix one and Microsoft would do the Windows one. And I think it's because they thought the Windows one wouldn't matter.
Windows is all over the place.
and that ended up being an interesting decision.
So. Definitely. And you know, what's interesting is that they all have backgrounds, right? Like some of the stuff, like, you know, you go to C and its background's Berkeley. And surprising enough, you know, Postgres, its background is from the Berkeley. So they got some funding. There was an earlier database called Ingress. They made it Postgres. That happened around, let me check my notes, 1986.
Yep.
And at that point, and then at that point, you know what the problem was, A, is that they didn't really have support for SQL. So in 1995, they decided to come out with Postgres 95. And we know how that goes when you put a number behind something. Then you get Windows 95, then Windows 98. You don't want to do that. So they at least they were smart enough in 96 to go, we're not going to do this anymore. We're going to call it Postgres SQL. So that's the origin. Mm-hmm. It's basically, it was originally Ingress, and it had its own query language, and they added SQL query language, as well as they rewrote the engine. And again, this is interesting. We see patterns over and over again, right? And the Spark was rewritten for Photon for Databricks in C++ recently to go faster, right? And guess what? They did the same thing back in 96. They had a bunch of stuff that was probably written in Java or something, and they rewrote it back in C to go faster. So yeah, it's a very colorful history, but it's an interesting product. Now, the question you asked me is why?
Yeah.
Two reasons why. First is, if you look at DB rankings, there's only four databases out there, right? Oracle still has number one. There's MySQL, there's SQL Server, and Postgres ranks number four. So if you're definitely in the want to be a SQL developer, and you know there's not too many jobs left to do backups and restores, because a lot of Azure platforms automatically do that for you, then you have to know these databases. And the second thing is, my client, I can't tell you who, but a big healthcare client down in Tennessee asked me to migrate some databases from SQL Server over to Postgres. So that's where I got introduced to Postgres, and I really like it. Yeah. I'm probably going to be writing some articles to share on it.
Yeah, look, I found with it, there was a period many years ago where I would look at Postgres and it was okay at what I saw. I did like their developer focus much more than what was happening in the SQL Server team. And I know with the SQL Server people, I used to keep talking to them about it, and I kept saying, you've just got to keep watching this, because there's a cutover point at where initially there was a huge difference between the two. But then there's this cutover point where it's good enough, you know, and that's the one that the Oracles and SQL Servers just have to, you know, had to keep an eye on. Now, I mean, is it good enough? You know, well and truly, it is, right, for the vast majority of applications. Is there still a difference? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I go to local Postgres user group meetings when they have them, and often I'll see them discussing things as concepts, and I think, I've had that for a decade, you know, or more in SQL Server. So there are things like that. But then there's other things that they just raise a sharp on because there's a developer focus and contributions.
Yeah, there's a lot of inheritance things that you can do in Postgres that you cannot do in SQL Server. Like, for instance, you can create a table inherited from another table. So all the columns come over automatically. You don't get that unless you put it in models, right? So there's some interesting things there. Also, you can, they got some base data types that our database, you know, and I call our database, but MySQL we mostly work in, don't have, for instance, vectors and also arrays. And so there's a lot of internal support that, you know, Microsoft finally caught up to them, like on some like JSON and stuff, but there's some really cool stuff that you can do in Postgres. One of the things I'd like to write an article on, I haven't had a chance to look into, is full text indexing. It's one of my pet peeves, you know, let's go faster with, you know, text. And, you know, what it does is it does the same thing that Microsoft does, but you get to look at the internals, like the parsing, the kicking out. You don't see what Microsoft does. It's all hidden behind the covers. But this, guess what? It puts it into that vector, and you can look at the vector.
I was going to say, there are ways to, but oh my goodness. Yeah, it's non-trivial.
It's so high compared to this. It's just out there, and it's like, yes. And then you get to pick what indexing strategy you want to do on it, right? Mm-hmm. Like Microsoft, if I remember, they're using a inverted, right?
Yeah, well, look, it is one of the things that I've interesting you mentioned table inheritance, because whenever I use an example with the SQL Server team and say, here's an example of something that developers would really like, table inheritance is pretty high on my list there. Now, I think there's things you could do better about than how it's done and so on. But it's interesting that over the years, with custom data types, one of the big problems we had with SQL CLR is that we couldn't create custom index types. And I kept saying to them, you know, we have it's pointless sort of giving us the ability to do, you know, things with the data types if we can't also do the index types. And what was interesting, then when they did spatial in 2008, is they made it a CLR type, but they made their own index type, right? And so we can't do that, you know. And but since then, anyway, I mean, SQL CLR was going to be the option really for how to do custom data types and things, but I don't use it anymore, even though I used to really quite like things about it, simply because it doesn't live in all the different platforms where I work. And predominantly, the fact that it's not there in Azure SQL Database and things like that, I mean, to me, it's almost dead to me now. And so I really wish for a stronger extensibility story. And that's one of the things I do find with Postgres.
It's tough either way you go, right? Because if you start writing custom code to extend the engine, unless you're making the extension that is totally plug-in, which basically, you know, Postgres allows you to do that.
Yep.
The problem with CLR, it was very fragile because it was very dependent upon the GAC and the GAC versions, right? And so it was easy to break. And if something's easy to break, my philosophy after doing this 35 years is keep it simple, stupid, right? Yep. If I can make it really simple, I can understand it, and someone else can understand it, more than 9 times out of 10, I don't get a call in the middle of the night saying it's broken.
Yeah, look, I think the next main thing for a lot of people was the licensing situation. And
it, definitely,
to me, it was very different to the Linux Windows discussion because, like, I would go into discussions and people would be talking about, you know, Linux didn't have a licensing cost, Windows did. But the thing is, in the cost of a project that I was involved with, that was such shrapnel that really didn't come into the discussion, right? But when you're talking about a database engine, that was serious money involved in the licensing.
Definitely. And that's one of the great things. You know, I mean, depends on how you do it. Do you want to manage it or do you not want to manage it? I don't want to talk about the options, but you got the IaaS option. If you go that way, you got full control. But guess what? You got to make sure you do your backups. You want, you know, high availability. You're going to be customing it, handling it, and you're going to be worrying about, you know, failing over and failing back, right? Not a service. But on the flip side, if you do it, then yeah, you're going to get charged. Not only, even Microsoft's going to charge you for the Linux plus probably some extra just to maintain it for you. So the cool thing, it's free. That's the cool thing about Postgres.
The one thing that's bringing that discussion back a bit for me, though, at the moment, is that most of the time when I would want to deploy it now, I actually want to deploy it as a platform service. And then in that case, the difference in cost in a SQL Server and a Postgres platform service, it is nothing like the difference when because basically you're paying for the service.
Exactly. So they're pretty comparable when you get to PaaS, but if you're rolling your own, then you can save some serious money.
Yeah. All good. And so in terms of things you found, so what were the things that surprised you most when you started getting involved with it?
Sure. So the reason why I got involved with it was a client wanted me to migrate a bunch of databases. So some of the cool features I liked and I found out about were some of the things kind of aligned to like Oracle. Like you got table spaces, which is interesting. So you can build a table space and then you can deploy a database to it. Do I know the internals of Postgres as a guru? No. I know it's in that directory. There's a bunch of weird files going on. Okay, cool. One of the things that was kind of a gotcha, someone that might be going new to, you know, Postgres and say, oh yeah, I want to do a ton of inserts and then updates and then deletes. The problem is that Postgres uses a interesting concurrency model. Okay, it's called multi-value
concurrency, consistency,
multi-version consistency control. Right, MVCC. I got it better than explaining it, but the main thing is that that can cause bloat because now you have copies and the indexes and the copy and the data, and it actually has a vacuum process. Kind of reminds me of Java, you know.
Yeah.
Comes and collects up the garbage.
Garbage collection,
Exactly. So you can see your performance on a database that's extremely intensive OLTP, then Postgres might not be a good fit. However, if you're doing analytical reporting or is it medium to moderate loads, then I think Postgres is going to be an awesome fit.
Indeed.
Now, one of the interesting things is that after you deploy a database, you can create schemas, and you know what? You might get used to, hey, it's the pub schema now versus the DBO schema. So that's something that's different, right? And also, one of the things you first do when you, after you deploy a table, right, you say, how do I give access to it, right? Usually in SQL Server, you create a logon, you create a user, you map it to the database, all that fun stuff, right? In Postgres, they used to have that. Now everything's a role.
Yeah.
And the only difference between a role that can actually log on and a role that's a security is just a flag that says you can log on. So, you know, there's some definite differences. The one thing I think is really weird, and I'd love them to see them do more work on it, but again, it's a community project, and it's tough to get, you know, people up in arms and redo all this work, right, is to the dump feature, right? The dump feature for backups just dumps all of it as a SQL script. So it's kind of crazy. It's almost like a backpack.
Yeah. Yeah, I must admit, I wasn't in love with the backup via dump. Yep.
Exactly. I'd like a binary, let me shot it, go fast, get it dumped, let's encrypt it, all that good stuff we have in SQL. Hmm. We just don't have that in Postgres.
What about the tooling? Did you end up using pgAdmin? Or?
I love pgAdmin. One thing you have to worry about pgAdmin is when you create a query, it's really bound to the actual logon that you use to open up that query window. So if I open it up to, say, my pubs database, and I want to switch over to public, which there are pgAdmin, which is their admin database, I can't do that. I have to create another window or close the window I have and re-log in. Little differences like that, but other than that, it's a really good tool.
Yeah. And command line, psql?
Yep. So they have a pgsql command line. One of the things that would be good for is like if you want to script something, like you want to run a one-time script for some load or something like that, that's awesome.
And with scheduling, do you use pgagent or just do stuff in cron or?
It depends where you are, right? And it depends, like, if one of the things we talked about is extensions, and you talked about Spatial, right? And the first introduction to Postgres myself was about 5 years ago, and I actually worked with some rocket scientists. I have to call them rocket scientists because they were actually, they were like PhDs in astrophysics, right? And the thing was, we were bidding on a contract for the U.S. Air Force, and they gave us all these spatial points of all the ships and all these satellites, and they want to know when you can contact a satellite. And I was all excited. I wanted to do it in Databricks, so like, no, just stand up pgAdmin for us, please. Stand up some clusters to talk to pgAdmin, and when we're done, help us get the data over using azcopy. I was like, oh, my fun. I didn't get a chance to really work on it. But that was a really interesting – Postgres GIS, on the other hand, is an extension. It used to be totally not installed, but now it comes part of the product. You install it, it's right there.
Yeah, no, it's been good. And so, look, in terms of when you just got started then, and I imagine creating tables is one of the first things. And so what did you find doing that?
Yeah, let's talk about, you know, how did I migrate, right? The problem is that I looked around, I was like, okay, how can we actually do this, right? And there's a script out there, and again, let me see if I can get the link to it.
For Wide World Importers, I did end up code-genning the whole thing myself to get it in the format that I wanted it,
Yep, that's one way to do it. Let me see if I can find it. Okay, there's a Perl conversion script out there, and I'll you know, if you want, I can put the link in, but you can go to my repo,
you can do that,
and that'd be perfect. That script is really good, but has a few bugs in it. And the reason why I like this is that you go into, say, pubs, which I did, and you want to get just the tables, right? So you script out the tables and indexes, okay? There's a few things that Perl script doesn't handle. And we talked about custom data types. It doesn't like custom data bytes. So if you have custom data bytes, replace them with basic data types, you're done. It breaks it into three scripts. The first script is just the DOM tables. Now, one of the things you're going to find is different in SQL versus PostgreSQL, SQL Server versus Postgres. Mm-hmm. Two things: names, lowercase. Okay, that's the convention for Postgres. Second thing is, guess what? You don't have to worry about nvarchar. Everything is nvarchar, but it's always, you have to worry about case now because it's case, you know, sensitive. So you have to worry about, if you want to look for something, you have to use an I like.
Yeah, instead.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, actually, the case sensitivity is a thing. I've always considered it a sort of a pox on computing that should be eliminated for anyone except for in bizarre situations. You know, I mean, I was reading again Bob Duffy from Ireland, again posting yesterday about a new thing in Fabric where somebody had pipeline with a capital L in the middle of pipeline and one lower and things just blowing out. You know, like, surely we should be past this by now. You know, I'm keen on case preservation. Like, I mean, whatever I put it in as, I want it to stay like that. But, you know, the idea that I query things and that's all case sensitive to me, that's just for the birds. And particularly with data, you know, in anything that's like normal business applications, analytics, I mean, granted, there are other scenarios where it matters, but I would rather specify it in those situations rather than have it that way.
So you almost want a fuzzy search. I don't care what it is.
No, not really fuzzy, but more. See, I look at case sensitivity, and all it lets you do is have two objects in the same scope that differ only by capitalization, right? Yep. And it would take a long time to convince me in computing that was ever a good idea.
Right? Okay, because, that's one way to do it.
Yeah, it was because, yeah. But anyway, so, yeah, case sensitivity you got to deal with. The other one that is different in like varchar, most people building Postgres things tend not to specify a size, although you might want to and you still can. But one of the things that I actually really like is that when they say varchar 10, they mean 10 characters. And even though it's UTF-8, it doesn't matter if that's 1 byte, 2 bytes, 3 bytes, 4 bytes, they mean 10 characters. To me, in SQL Server, the way they implemented UTF-8 is completely broken. I mean, so if I say varchar 10, that means somewhere between 2 and 10 characters will fit. To me, that is just beyond useless. I mean, I don't care what the data length is of those characters. I just want to specify the number of characters. And so fortunately, Postgres does that.
Yes, it does. One thing I would think, though, and again, I saw, unless I, like I'm saying again, I'm a newbie, but I thought there was a limit on the varchar, like there was no varchar max for the Postgres.
Yeah. That is not the equivalent of that. So, yeah, indeed.
So you're limited 8,000. So it's kind of like old school, like real back to time. It's like, I can't put 2 gig in my table.
Most of the data types, I don't recall finding any particular problems with most of that. One thing that did throw me that I don't know if you noticed, but it doesn't allow you to name things like default constraints and so on. And again, the difference is in Postgres, you don't need to. And so the thing is, in SQL Server, I always name my default constraints.
But you don't have to. You could get a weird name.
You could get a weird name. But the problem is, if I go to drop a column, the first thing I have to do is drop the constraint, and I don't then know the name of the constraint.
Then you have to hit the system table and figure it out. Yeah,
it becomes so complicated, right? So I always name them so I know what they're called. So if I need to drop it, I can just drop it, right, and so on.
Definitely.
But the sensible option, which is in Postgres, is if you drop the column, it drops any associated default for you.
Well, I'll tell you a really cool feature in Postgres, and let's not tell everyone to go try it, but you can do drop schema cascade.
Yeah.
See the thumbs up here? Yeah. That is awesome when you want to rebuild something. You're just like, get rid of that, and then let's rebuild it.
Yes.
Versus a lot of times you're like, oh, I have to drop this table. To drop this table, it has a foreign key. I have to drop this.
Or drop the
whole database. Let's just drop schema. Boom, it's gone. I can rebuild it. Thank you.
It's actually in the SDU tools I have for SQL Server. Empty schema has actually been a very popular option, which I actually use, I might add, for installing SDU tools as well. So,
there you go.
But I am starting to build those out for Postgres. So at some point, I will have a Postgres version of those as well. So we'll see how that goes.
Let's go back to like the question you asked, like what I found like for migration, what was the difficulties? So that script's just one script. You can buy scripts out there. Yep. It's like anything though. The problem is the complexity. Let's break it down to data versus code, right? If you talk about the data, it's just tables and indexes. That's easy. Mm-hmm. That's easy peasy, right? Even Vue's the easy peasy, right?
Yeah.
There's only so many ways you can write the SQL statement, right? More than likely, it's not going to be that complex. Where the problems you get into is the stored procedures. So the nice thing about the tool is it first scripts out the tables. That allows you to do a data port import. Doesn't matter what tool you want to use. Like, could use SSIS if you want, or whatever, you know. ETL
in fact, that's a good question, is that what do you use in terms of a driver for connecting? Is it?
Good question. There's two of them. For those developers out there, Java-based, there's a JDBC driver.
JDBC? Mm-hmm.
Yep, and I used that with this client. I was using Apache NiFi. Have you ever heard of Apache NiFi?
NiFi? Nope.
Such a niche product. Got to look at it one of these days. I have to blog about it. I spent 6 months on it. It's interesting. It was done by NSA, and everything is like flow files, but that used JDBC. And other ones you can use ODBC, obviously.
Hmm. Cool. And so connectivity there. So you, in that case, you've used SSIS, which again,
you can
would
use
work
SSIS
fine.
Yeah. Or whatever you want. And then once you get the data,
or if you're being in the cloud, Data Factory will work fine and so on.
Exactly. Whatever tool, it could be Fabric. I mean, they all work.
Yeah.
And then once you get the data in, right, you want to build your indexes and then your constraints and then the views. And then the hardest part that I spent most of the time on is refactoring basically the business logic, right? And the problem with business logic is I have a love-hate with my first professor, and I'll put his name here, Frank Carano. He was great, great professor. Hate was he always pushed me, oh, worry about spacing, always worry about comments. He took off points for it. And guess what? 35 years later, I thank him for it because all my code, when you look at it, it's well-documented, it's well-structured. Mm-hmm. Everything looks the same regardless of whatever tool I'm using. That's the problem you're going to fall into when you refactor it, because you're going to get a pile of spaghetti code. You're not going to know what it is. You're going to have to go refactor it. Some things that you could use during refactoring, I thought was really cool, and this is another interesting point that's different between SQL Server and Postgres, is materialized views. Have you looked at the materialized views?
Yeah, indeed.
Hi, this is Greg coming to you from another time and place. If you have a data-related project that needs to get off to a great start with the right architecture, or if you have an existing project that's off the rails, why not contact us? We help organizations of all sizes, from startups to tier one financials, and we can help you too. Check us out at sqldownunder.com.
Yeah, in fact, the SQL Server is probably the odd one out in terms of how it does indexed views compared to most other database engines that do have them.
Yeah, and it's interesting is that with SQL, right, we take a table, and then what we do is we materialize the index. So every time the table changes, the index has to be updated. Mm-hmm. So you get a lot of going back and forth during production. And you might not want that. You might want a snapshot and say, hey, just take this lookup table. It's good enough. It's a day old. Put it out there. It's just the rates that we have for, like, you know, money. Well, guess what? Now you don't have to worry about it. And it keeps track of the SQL that built it. So when you want to refresh it, you just say, hey, refresh it. It knows what to do. And then just rebuilds your materialized table, which is awesome.
Yeah, I do wish we had both options available in the SQL Server side. But I do actually like the scenario as well, where it can do the updates on the fly all the time as well. And I mean, there's use cases for both, but I do see two problems with index views in SQL Server. Number one is that if you have a heavy update load, then it can just become horrible, you know, what's going on. But the other thing that's always a problem that people don't think about is the set options for the connections in SQL Server is that effectively what you're doing is storing the answer to a query. And the answer to a query depends upon the options you've chosen at the time you ran the query, right? So unless you have a specific set of set options, then even if you have an index view, you're not going to get the answer because the system's not going to return it to you because, you know, if you had a different ANSI null setting or a different, you know, quoted identifier setting, it has to go and get the data again anyway.
Yeah, and that's the nice thing about having a real table persisted. You know, it's just
It's just a table.
Just query the damn thing.
Look, a lot of people do run into, I noticed they do collide with MVCC and vacuum and stuff like that when they first hit it because it is, again, different in how it does it. Apart from having it auto vacuum, is there anything that you found you needed to do or to worry about in that area?
Not really, because we used, you know, the service, right? We went, the client I was using. And again, I want to say that Postgres is all over there. It's multi-cloud, right? So you go to AWS, you get a version. This client happened to be using Google. So there's something called Cloud SQL, and we were using Cloud SQL Postgres. So that works there. And then, of course, Azure SQL Database, quote, Postgres version is out there too. Now, there's two flavors for the Azure version. There was a standalone, and there's a flexible. Standalone's gone away. Please deploy the flexible. It's a great service. Just remember this. You can turn it off. But I hate this. It automatically turns on every 7 days to do a backup.
Yes.
So I always forget that, and I've been wanting. Thank you for reminding me. I've been wanting to write a job, and since you reminded me, I'm going to put this on my to-do list this weekend. Mm-hmm. So I get finally a chance to do some writing again. I will write a quick job to turn that puppy off because I just don't want to get charged every time it turns it back.
Having
on.
It all the time. Yeah, actually, it's interesting.
You know, those MVP pennies that we get, right?
What has that done to the entry-level cost, though, for getting into that? Because my recollection is that the single server stuff was comparative to the SQL Server, like Azure SQL Database. But the flexible server was a much bigger jump up by the time you got to that.
I think they lowered the bar a little. You'll have to go take a look. Every time a client asks me that, I go to a pricing tool. My budget and your budget might be totally different, so definitely go look at it. That's for sure. Again, there's always the option to just get a VM, and you can put it on Linux, and it's really quick. Yeah. One of the things I did find out, though, when I did some writing for MSQL Tips, is that the Windows performed a little slower than the Linux, and it wasn't surprising because, you know, Linux is really cut down, doesn't have all that stuff running in the background. You know, it doesn't worry about, hey, you know, do you want to get an Outlook notification or whatever the junk that's running in the OS. But so that I did like the Linux version.
So what about the surrounding things? So do you end up playing with replication?
So unfortunately, this client didn't have get to that point, and so they just wanted to do a POC. I think you're going to find is this: if you're taking an existing MSQL database and you think you're going to save a ton of money by going ahead and refactor it, you're going to find the man hours to refactor it and fix it and make it performant is going to be more than the savings that you're going to get. So I suggest if you're on MSQL and you have performance problems, fix those performance problems and live with it. Or if you really want to migrate over, just put it in a bucket. That's going to cost you some money to do the change.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like, where do you want to spend the money? Because, indeed. There's no magic bullet with just migrated and suddenly this is faster or slower. Indeed. Yeah, or better. What about high availability, though? Did they have anything in that regard?
No, this client, unfortunately, we didn't get into that, but you can set up high availability. And one of the cool things about high availability with the flexible server is you just hit a slider and it just suddenly spins up another server for you. And it's not in a different zone. It's zone redundant. It's not data center redundant. So if you like in East US and there's two data centers a mile away in Virginia, then you'll be in one, you'll be in another, and if something happens to one, like a fire or something cool went down, it'll go over to the other. But it's not as good as like east to west. So that's what I
remember. I know originally Microsoft was trying to have pairs of data centers that were at least 500 kilometers apart or roughly 300 odd miles or something, and the and in the same geopolitical region. You know, that was the sort of plan. And they've pretty much followed that. You know, when I look at the pairs of data centers all over the place, it often does worry me where I see people and, yeah, everything they're doing in terms of HA and so on, or disaster recovery, sorry, is almost next door or in the same building or something, and you think, no, you know, that's not what you want at all.
It's not as bad as having the server on top as the AC duct, right?
And it
dripped down and then, like, the whole thing went, you know? So it's a little better than that, I think.
What about, I suppose the final thing is just about ongoing monitoring. And once you had it in and you have it, what did you find you need to do to keep an eye on it?
So there's a couple things you can do. If you're old school like me and you want to roll your own, then what you can do is in those store procedures that are kind of heavy and doing all the business logic for you, mm-hmm. you could do some of your own logging. Why I like doing that is because, you know what it does is I don't have to go to another tool and figure out what the other tool is.
Totally agree.
I know it's like, hey, guess what? It locked here. It took 3 minutes last time. Now it's taking 3 hours. What happened? Mm-hmm. I need to check this query out, right?
Yep.
So that's one way to do it. Another way is if you're in Azure, they have quote unquote query store for PostgreSQL. It's there. Do not delete the database. If you see something that says Azure, don't delete it. You need it. Okay. There's also a Postgres version that's called Statistics. Again, I haven't looked at it. This is all, you get me thinking all these juices, Greg, about all the stuff I want to do this year. I don't know if I'll get to everything that's on my bucket list, but that's one of the things is like, how do you, you know, look at the performance and how do you do a baseline and how do I go back to that baseline? But yeah, again, some of the old school tricks, just have an audit table. Just, you know, put your data for all your, you know, executions where
it's not just databases, right? I mean, I've grown up where I tend to have instrumentation in the database code, but I mean, I do the same in applications as well. You know what I mean?
Like exactly
at each layer. I mean, you're going to have instrumentation that you can work with, and then you have a clue what's going on, you know, when something doesn't play nicely. Or, and certainly in the case of any substantial procs that do loads or things and stuff, yeah, we always have like logging tables that record when it starts doing things and record when it finishes and so on. And yeah, it's a world of goodness to be able to just go, where did this get up to, or what stopped, or, you know, yes, as you said, why is this 3 hours and it used to be 2 minutes, you know, and so on and so on. Yeah, definitely. It is literally not rocket science to have that sort of logging in place in the system. So yeah, that's good. I should have asked though about stored procs. What did you find anything very different about procs or functions? Or
oh yeah, there's a lot of differences there. So triggers are really unique. Okay, they have their own return type. Let's step back even before we get into this. When you're doing Postgres, you have to make a conscious decision. Are you going to be a programmer and use a programming language for stored procedures and functions? Mm-hmm. Or are you going to use SQL? Now, I'm a SQL guy. I mean, I've done a lot of programming in the 90s. I did a ton of VB programming. And in 2000, I did some C# programming. But when I made a conscious decision to get in databases, I was like, guess what? I got a master's in database science. I'm going to just do SQL, right? Because I know that. I'm really good at that. So you have to make that choice. There's the languages that support are Perl, Python, and PG SQL. So let's say we pick PG SQL. Next thing is every time you do something in Postgres, it's kind of like MySQL also, in which you have to put a block around it. And in that block, you have to actually give it a mnemonic. So they use $$, and if you want, you could say func1 for function 1 and then end function 1. So that's your do loop, right? Your begin and end. And at the end, you have to tell it what language you want to write in. So once we get that away, that's the housekeeping, the language. Now let's talk about all the different ways to do stuff. And there's so many different ways that are new and different in Postgres. And the only thing I have to say is read the manual. That's for sure. One thing about triggers is interesting is that you create a trigger and it says return trigger type. Now, when you think about a before let's say an NAFTA trigger, right? You want to do a rollback. Mm-hmm. You get your inserted and deleted tables, right? Depending upon what you're looking at. Yeah. And then you can make decisions on it. Like, hey, I want to do this. I want to do that. This is totally different. And Postgres, what it does is it executes the code you have for every single record. I mean, at least the way I've done it. And so you have to get in that mindset. It's like, I'm not working with a whole record set. I'm working with a record. And therefore, there is a record
which
type.
Is more like the Oracle mechanism, right? So I find people coming from Oracle, one of the things they struggle with if they ever deal with triggers is they end up in SQL Server, they end up writing single row triggers. You know,
no!
all the time. And that's
no!
that's the thing, right? And so, yeah, the idea that in SQL Server, you fire the trigger, it fires once for all the whatever's changed. Yeah. So, but yeah, other databases let you do it in the context of an individual row.
And that gets used, you have to get used to that for sure. Hmm. Another thing is return sets, right? Like you can, in the problem with stored procedures in Microsoft's really nice. You get marsed, right? Multiple result sets. And not only that, you don't have to declare what they're going to be. They just come through back and it says, hey, it's tabular data stream. This is this data. This is this data. It just does it for you. Postgres is not that easy. So if you want to do that, right, I found the easiest is to anything I was doing stored procedures that I want to return something, I created functions because they're just easier to call. And then I could define the type that I'm returning as a table type and I knew exactly what I was returning. But yeah, you're going to run into things like that. That's for sure.
Hmm. Any difference you found in the balance of using functions, which, I mean, in T-SQL, people tend to avoid functions like the plague, well, at least scalar functions. And
They seem pretty performant for me, so I didn't have any issues with them. So, again, it's all – I chose the code, and behind the scene, it just ran pretty good.
Yep. Excellent. Well, listen, that's pretty much bring us to time. John, look, is there anywhere people will see you with things coming up or anything happening?
Yeah. Definitely. I told Jeremy this year I'm going to be writing about PostgreSQL. I always try to pick a new topic to learn, try to expand my horizons. And Databricks at Emma SQL Tips. So please go to Emma SQL Tips and stay tuned. I should be writing more about Postgres this year. Thank you for having me. And one of the things we didn't talk about is indexing. So if you want to look at Postgres indexes, there's a plethora of indexes there too.
Yes,
so
really cool. I'm sure we will end up having a show specifically just on indexes. That's absolutely for sure. In fact, it is one of those things that's completely different. The fact that there's so many types of index and so on, which is a bit of a surprise. Although there are quite a number in SQL Server that people don't often stop and think about, you know, the different types. But even so. But listen, so thank you so very much for your time today, John.
Awesome. Hey, thank you for letting me do this. And you have an awesome weekend.